third case for oral argument this morning is, Travelers Insurance Company appellants and Bodle Construction Company also appellants versus Hargall Construction, the appellee. For the appellee, we have Mr. Tim Johnson, attorney from Lead, and for the appellants, we have Mr. Scott Sumner, an attorney from Rapid City. Justice Conan Camp has disqualified himself on this matter. The court has appointed the Honorable Mark Barnett, Circuit Judge from the 6th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Conan Camp's place. Mr. Sumner, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. I please the court, counsel. Again, my name is Scott Sumner. I'm here on behalf of all of the appellants. This case presents as a very straightforward construction dispute where the people and the parties involved are the owner of the project, the general contractor, and one of the subcontractors on this project. There's really nothing unusual about the contract arrangements. There is a written general contract between the owner and the general contractor that has the normal set of standard specifications, technical specifications, and the plans that are part of the project. The general contractor has fully performed the construction contract with the owner. The owner has fully paid the general contractor for that work. What we have, in truth here, is a dispute between one subcontractor and the general contractor concerning the scope of work that was required of that subcontractor under its subcontract agreement. But before we get to the scope of work question, looking at the structure of this case, which is presented as a mechanics lien claim by the subcontractor against the owner, and then in the alternative, it is presented as an unjust enrichment claim by the subcontractor against the owner. One would think that there would be a contract claim between the subcontractor and the general contractor, that being the true nature of this dispute, but there is no such allegation in this particular case. There's a parallel case where that has been presented.
There's two parallel cases, aren't there?
Well, sort of. There is a separate lawsuit where Hargall has sued Bodell Construction on the contract. And the particular circumstances of that lawsuit, although we were served, the summons complaint in that case was not filed when I went to file the answer. And I was concerned that the counsel for Hargall was engaged in some strategy that somehow would seek to obviate the arbitration provision of the subcontract. And I was very concerned to make certain that we did not waive our right to assert the arbitration clause. So I, on behalf of Bodell, initiated another case to demand the arbitration take place. But it's, I guess, two sides of the same issue. It's the same parties.
And none of the corollary cases are on appeal.
Correct. None of them have moved beyond the pleading stage. They've been held in abeyance pending this case. In the particular context of this case, I believe, and as asserted with our brief on appeal, that under the mechanics lien claim, there's no need to reach any substantive issues on the underlying case because the mechanics lien itself is defective. It's defective for two reasons. Number one, it was not timely filed. And number two, it is not adequately itemized. And if the court should agree with the appellant on either of those two questions, and therefore rule that there is no valid enforceable mechanics lien, then there is no need to reach the underlying issues insofar as they are encompassed within the mechanics lien claim. On the first assertion with regard to the mechanics lien that it was not timely filed, this presents as a pretty standard dispute. The subcontractor, Hargall, completed its work on this project in the summer of 2005. There's a little bit of variation in the testimony and the evidence as to exactly when. There's a bill for 100% of the work early in the summer. There's a letter saying we're leaving the job in July. There's a there are several things, but I don't think there's any dispute about the fact that they were done, gone, complete, packed up, and out of the job by the end of August of 2005. The mechanics lien was not filed until January 17th of 2006, well beyond the 120-day period for filing mechanics lien from and after that work. The only work that Par Golf can cite to as a basis upon which to assert that the mechanics lien was timely filed is certain repair work that it did in September of 2005. The law as advanced by this court is very clear that repair work or warranty work will not operate to extend the period of time within which to file a mechanics lien. I don't think there's really any dispute about it being repair work. Their invoice says as much. Their own testimony says as much. It's a question of how the law should be applied to these facts, and we believe very clearly the law should be applied to defeat the mechanics lien, and there need be no reason to go further. On the question of itemization, this case was originally submitted with a mechanics lien of $64,560.30. And you have to excuse me a little bit sometimes the numbers don't add up because there has been some variation in the evidence about the specific figures, but that's the specific amount of the original lien. As the case progressed, eventually the Par Golf's attorney acknowledged that they had failed to itemize all but $20,252.52 of this lien. And that acknowledgement on their part is very clearly borne out by the mechanics lien itself, which is in Exhibit 3 in the plaintiff's exhibits. And of the dollar amount in that mechanics lien, for $64,560.30, a part of that amount alleged has to do with amount still due and owing under retainage and change order under the contract, and there's no attempt whatsoever to attach anything to the mechanics lien to document that part of the claim. Then there's a claim for extras for $29,100, and there's no invoice or any description whatsoever attached to the mechanics lien for that $29,100 except a line item on a later invoice that carries that as a balance forward. So there's no itemization of that dollar figure whatsoever. The only attempt at itemization on the mechanics lien is an invoice for, I think it's $19,007, might be some pennies there, which is by and large a claim for extras. There's $1,027.52 in a change order in that. But if you look at the invoice itself, which is part of Exhibit 3, you'll see that it's just lump sum numbers that go down. There is inadequate description to conform with the guidance of this court with regard to the documentation of a mechanics lien. And the same is true on the last item for $1,245, which is the only two items that they're claiming on the mechanics lien. If the court agrees with me on either the timing issue or the itemization issue, there need be no reason to go further on the mechanics lien claim. We believe that this court should reverse the trial court and remand with instructions to enter a judgment for the defendants and against the plaintiff on the mechanics lien claim.
What was the $1,000 for?
The
$1,000 amount that you just added on to?
That was an invoice that they sent for this repair work in September. Okay. Then for now I'm going to delay discussing the underlying claim for a minute and go forward to count two, which is a claim for unjust enrichment. This claim is asserted against Walmart, the owner of the project. As I said at the beginning of this case, Walmart had a contract with a general contractor to construct this store. The general contractor has fully performed that contract and has constructed the store, and Walmart has fully paid the general contractor for that work. There is no dispute between the general contractor and the owner respecting the scope of work required of the general contractor under that contract. What we have instead is a dispute where there is an argument or dispute between the general contractor and the subcontractor with regard to the scope of the subcontractor's work. It being more or less the position, like, the owner acknowledges that this work had to be done, the general contractor acknowledges that this work had to be done for Walmart, and that it has been paid in full for that work, but the subcontractor claims it had a restriction in its subcontract that limited the scope of its responsibility to something less than the plans and specifications.
So why didn't you try that case first?
Try which case first?
Why didn't you try that case between the subcontractor and the contractor first?
Well, we attempted to have that matter referred to arbitration and were defeated in that attempt. The count two of the amended complaint wasn't presented in this case until essentially the day before originally was set for trial. And the way the case proceeded, this matter got brought to trial first because of the scheduled calendar of the court. It had been pending a long time before count two was ever added to the case. In effect, though, in this circumstance, the well, mechanics lien was filed against the owner's property early on. The general contractor acquired a bond, mechanics lien release bond, and pursuant to the procedures in SDCL 44-4, obtained a discharge of the mechanics lien against the owner's property, and the security for the mechanics lien was transferred to the surety bond, upon which the general contractor was the principal and Travelers was the surety. Walmart, in effect, was then removed as a party to the mechanics lien case, and Bodell, the general contractor, as the principal on the mechanics lien release bond, was a party to the mechanics lien foreclosure at that point in time. And so Bodell did assert bring into issue in this case the very matter we're talking about the scope of the contract. There was significant evidence in the case on this issue, it being the general contractor's position that the work by the subcontractor was included within the scope of work they were required to do under their subcontract, while the subcontractor argued to the contrary. But that is an underlying contract dispute. Looking specifically to the claim for unjust enrichment by the subcontractor against the owner, the guidance from this court is that there has to be some unusual circumstance where it would be inequitable to allow the owner of the property to retain the benefit of the work performed by the claimant without paying for it. And the circumstance we have here is that the owner has paid for it. And so there is no...
Just a minute, though. On that issue, you know, the circuit court found there's no evidence Walmart paid for the extra work or the retainage. And I didn't see that you had challenged that finding as clearly erroneous.
Well, we asserted all of our own findings, proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law to the contrary on that point.
Well, I mean, you didn't make an argument in your brief that finding is clearly erroneous.
I don't remember for sure. I would have thought we had.
Well, make one now if you got it then.
All right.
Whether it's in the brief or not.
All right. The undisputed evidence in this case was that Walmart paid in full. The testimony was presented into evidence through the testimony of Eric Reiber, the principal for the general contractor. There's simply no evidence to the contrary that Walmart is paid in full for the general contract.
But if the work was extra that was not required by the general contract, then the owner would not have paid by definition.
There was no claim to that effect presented by the subcontractor in this case. The general contractor is not presented such a claim to the owner in this case.
But isn't that the dispute between the general contractor and the subcontractor?
Well,
whether or not this is an extra, or whether or not the bulk of it anyway, whether the bulk of it's an extra that requires extra money,
okay,
or whether it's included.
I think we need to distinguish the contract between the general contractor and the owner, and the contract between the subcontractor and the general. You know, the general contractor, had, in this case, had 20 or 25 subcontractors. And they each have a different scope of work under the general contract. And then there's a portion of that work that is to be performed by the general contractor itself. The subcontractor's work doesn't encompass the 20 or 25 subcontractors don't encompass the entirety of the work for the owner. So we have each subcontract has its separate scope of work, and whatever is subcontracted out, then the general contractor has to complete. In this case, there was a dispute whether this subcontractor or that should perhaps be called upon to do the work. And, or separately, there is a dispute where this subcontractor, Pargall, says, listen, I put a restriction on my subcontract. And you, Mr. General Contractor, may owe a duty to the owner to do this, but I don't owe a duty to you as the general contractor. So we have to distinguish the claim for extras is, you might say, in a claim in a smaller scale. It does not seek to assert a claim that the work that was performed was beyond the scope of the general contract or was work for which the owner should pay any additional monies. In essence, the dispute is, should the general do this or should the subcontractor? But one way or the other, one of them's got to do it to fulfill the performance of the contract to the owner.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but just like let's just take one example. There was something about an extra planter that was added. Now, presumably, if that was added, I don't think there's a dispute about that.
That was added on a written change order, Judge. There's no dispute about that.
So that's something extra that wouldn't have been contemplated.
But we're not disputing that claim, and the claim for extras does not include that. That the specific planner was the subject of a specific written change order. The general contractor acknowledges is to be paid to the subject to the claim for offset. Because remember, in this case, the general acknowledges that there is approximately $16,125 that would still be due and owing on the written agreement, separate from the claim for extras. Except that the general contractor has an offset claim because the general asserts that the subcontractor didn't finish its work, and the general had to go in and finish the subcontractor's work and should receive an offset. That $16,125 includes the planner. So we're not arguing that scope issue. We gave them that in a change order.
But you're saying that the extras in general are all contemplated by the main contract?
Correct. Just a question of whether the general should do it or the subcontractor. As looking at the project as a whole.
What did the trial court mean then when...
I'm sorry, say it again?
What did the trial court mean when he found that there's no evidence Walmart paid for extra work or the retainage?
Well, in the context, we think that's an erroneous finding or conclusion, as the case may be, because there is no evidence in this case that there was any extra work provided to Walmart. All Walmart got was the billing it contracted with the general contractor for. All Walmart got was the very thing that it contracted for and that for which it paid in full. And so to the extent that they're claiming, and Walmart is paid in full, which would include the retainage, and that was the evidence at trial. There's no evidence to the contrary. So there was no claim for extras presented to Walmart because there was no extra work performed vis-a-vis the scope of the general contract. And Walmart has paid in full for the retainage, which is part of that $16,125. Okay, so Walmart's paid. Walmart's received what it paid for. This claim doesn't reach that level of dispute between Walmart and the general. And so what we have is a situation where there is no unjust enrichment. And there being no unjust enrichment, there is no claim against Walmart on count two of the amended complaint. So if you agree with me on the timeliness or the itemization of the mechanics lien, you must reverse count one of the amended complaint. If you agree with me that there is no unjust enrichment to Walmart since it is paid in full, then you must reverse on count two of the complaint and you never reach the underlying contract issues. If for some reason you should choose to reach the underlying contract issues, it is our assertion that dispute in its entirety should be referred to arbitration because the contract between the general and the subcontractor mandates arbitration. So if you refer to arbitration, then there's no reason to reach any further into the underlying contract issues. But if you do reach further into the underlying contract issues, you'll find that the contract in this case is very clear, that the subcontractor was obligated to provide services in conformance with the plans and specifications. The plans and specifications required the subcontractor to maintain the seated and sided areas, and the entire claim that the subcontractor is asserting is the claim for work performed in watering the sodded and seated areas, which are expressly required of it under the contract.
Well, I understand you to say that arbitration is not required. I mean, maybe this is an implication of the way you presented your argument this morning. But when I read the briefs, I thought you were saying arbitration was a prerequisite to consideration of any of this appeal. Now, this morning, if I understand what you're saying correctly, you're saying that the unjust enrichment and mechanics lien claims can be considered without arbitration in only the underlying contract dispute. Is that...
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a chicken and the egg, cart before the horse argument to figure out. And I guess I could see the argument going either way on that. But my view is that if there's no valid mechanics lien, which is a statutory question and a separate fact issue, separate and apart from the contract, then there's no reason to reach the contract issues under the mechanics lien claim, because if you don't have a valid mechanics lien, you don't have a claim or cause of action between the parties against which to address the issue of whether it should go to arbitration. And I postulate that under the unjust enrichment claim, since the evidence is that the owner contracted for a certain scope of work, the owner received only the work for which it contracted, the owner is paid in full for that work, likewise there's no reason to reach beyond that threshold issue to get into the contract.
Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Jones, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My client is Grant Neunkester. Grant, at the time of filing this lawsuit, had been a landscaper and a golf course constructor and maintainer for some 30 years, hence the name Par Golf. He brought the instant lawsuit against Walmart Real Estate Business Trust on two theories: lien foreclosure and unjust enrichment. Both of those are actions that lie in equity. The trial court found for him. The trial court did equity. We're asking that you affirm the trial court, since the court was not clearly erroneous in doing so. Par Golf was asked to provide some landscaping at this Walmart superstore, which is located over in Spearfish. The store is owned by a separate entity. Bodell contracted with the store. There is no contract lying between Bodell Construction and Walmart Real Estate Business Trust. The trust owns the property. The store owns the building. Par Golf contracts then with Bodell Construction. At no time did it bring an in personam action against the store or Bodell. Rather, its action was in rem against the land that was owned by the trust. That land was subject to a lien. Subsequently, they filed the bond, so then the lien was against the bond. Par Golf's contract required that with Bedell required him to plant trees, shrubs, and some perennials were called for by certain plans that were provided. They were also to install a drip irrigation system to water the trees, the bushes, and the perennials. That was done. The contract required him to, did not require him to provide any topsoil, although he was to finish the topsoil. It did not require him to provide any sod. It did require him to finish the topsoil, to mulch, and to stake an edge where it was called for by the plans. Finally, he was required to drill dry land grass seed, as you would plant a field of wheat. The idea was that this store was going to have all natural grasses. It was approved, the seed was approved by the architect. It was a DOT seed, which you would find in your road ditches throughout the state of South Dakota, which means that some of these seeds mature at different times. Some of them require a freezing and a thawing, and some will mature the first year, some will mature the second year. As indicated, the contract excluded any erosion control, except where the plans called for seed blankets. And there was the matter of the sod, which was only to be addressed by a later change order, if it was going to be required. They did everything that was required of them. They were done by mid-June of 2005, including correcting the items that were on the punch list from the architect. They were never paid for the full amount that was due to them under the written agreement. And not only did the appellants here renege on the original contract, they also reneged on the extra work that was required of Par Golf. Located on the property is a retention dam. And there was an issue with it. There's concrete inlets and outlets, and the dam was designed improperly and constructed improperly so that the inlet was not where it was supposed to be. There's a storm that occurs in April of 2005, and that caused all the banks to get washed out. It took all of the topsoil, put it into the bottom of the dam, and there was considerable erosion. By the time that had happened, Par Golf had seeded all the areas, and so they were done with their seeding. Bedell's project manager then, who was located in Billings, Montana, requested of Par Golf that they provide an operator for a dozer that was going to be hired by Bedell, rented by Bedell, so that they could put the banks back into the condition that they were to be. They also asked them that they reseed the area and water it. Par Golf agreed only upon receiving written confirmation from this project manager that they were going to pay for the time, or for their help for the operation of the bulldozer, for the rental of their water truck, and they would pay separately for the truck, as well as later on, it was determined that it was necessary to put in a temporary irrigation system, which then Par Golf also did. So there was watering with the truck for this area. There was the irrigation system that was also put in. No charges were ever assessed by Par Golf for the water, which is an issue that was brought up by the appellants, until after this Mr. John Urbentringer okayed the same. And that is reflected by the exhibits in the case as well as all the testimony. Par Golf then finishes with this extra work in August, leaves, and then they're called back to do additional work. There was damage that was caused to this irrigation system, and so they came back and repaired that. First issue raised by Bedell has to do with the matter of the arbitration. There's two provisions in the contract, the subcontract, that deal with arbitration. First, there's a dispute clause that's been referred to by Bedell. It requires arbitration between the contractor and the subcontractor where there's a dispute covering the scope of work. Par Golf never raised this issue in any of its claims concerning the scope of work, since it was clearly requested to do this extra work by Bedell. Secondly, there's a payment clause in that same contract that says, quote, contractor agrees to use his best efforts and due diligence to collect from the owner all sums earned by the subcontractor under this subcontract, and as long as contractor does so, subcontractor shall fully cooperate with and assist contractor in such efforts and shall not file suit or demand arbitration against contractor. Throughout these proceedings, Bedell has failed to make any showing that it ever used any efforts, much less best efforts, to collect monies due Par Golf as found by the trial court. Since all of the parties, the trust, the store, the insurance company, and Vidal have all been represented by the same law firm throughout the entire proceedings. Secondly, Par Golf never brought suit against Vidal. Instead, it was Vidal that raised these contract issues on its claimed offset, which could have been arbitrated, but instead, they submitted it to the trial court. They didn't like the decision of the trial court, now they raise the issue of arbitration before you. Thirdly, the cases that they cited, none of those cited by the appellant stand for the proposition that an arbitration provision in a subcontract can be asserted by a property owner, nor do they stand for the proposition that a third-party property owner who is not a principal on the contract with the general can assert such an arbitration clause in a subcontract between the general and the subcontractor. And finally, all of the cases that they've cited are lien foreclosure cases, and not one of them stands for the proposition that their holdings apply to an action for unjust enrichment against a third-party property owner. There's the issue of the timely filing. They claim that this repair work was warranty work. It was not warranty work. The trial court specifically found that it was repair damage to an irrigation system which is caused by vandals. Warranty work would be if there's a defect in the system that was sold or installed that didn't happen here. Warranty work, this work was completed on September 24th. Lien is filed on January 17th, 2006. We have the lien being filed within 120 days. They raise the issue of itemization. They claim that the lien was not sufficiently itemized. We admitted that the billing statement of July 20th, 2005 was erroneously omitted from the lien statement. I didn't do that. There was another attorney that prepared that and filed it. But in any event, it was discovered that it wasn't done. We didn't have any other choice but to admit.
Let's go back for just a minute. On your repair work claim, if there's a contract and say the contract runs through June and you're all done with the work with the contract in June, isn't that the time when the mechanics lien 120 days starts to run? And if you do some repair work afterwards, you can't tack that on to start from there. Correct?
We're saying that we were called to do extra work in September, and that it was not warranty work that we would otherwise be responsible for, and it was a continuation of the project.
I thought you just said it was repair work, not real warranty work.
Right. And I take the position that repair work, if it's in the nature of fixing something that was not any of our fault, that is additional work that should be tacked on.
That's the vandalism?
Yes.
All right. Getting back to your comment about not itemizing it, I take it then you don't seek to have that portion of the mechanics lien reinstated. You're just going to give up on that?
No, my position is it was sufficiently itemized. I think if you look at some of the other cases that this court's decided, McLaughlin and R&L Supply and Ringenberger and all of those which have discussed the sufficiency of itemization, that this statement would certainly qualify. It listed number of hours of operation water truck was used. It listed the number of man hours for both the operation of the dozer and the truck. It listed the number of feet that the irrigation system consisted of, and it indicated the price per foot. It listed the cost of the controller. It listed the mobilization cost. It listed to come back in September. I would take the position that it's sufficiently itemized, as did the trial court, that a reasonable person could find that or have notice of what was done. The purpose of the itemization clause is to avoid issues of fraud. Here it's sufficiently clear. The standard is whether or not we substantially complied, and I would argue that we did.
Is that a finding of fact, then, or is that a legal analysis? Whether it was itemized?
Ultimately, I believe it would be a legal conclusion.
But because there's really no dispute on what was itemized, so then we just and see if that was, as a matter of law, reasonable and careful. Is that the standard?
I believe so. I believe it was that language. You should be able to look at it and see what was done. You can look at this one and see what was done.
It's kind of a de novo review on that issue rather than a clearly erroneous abuse of discretion, anything like that.
I would concede that point.
Why did the trial court disallow part of it, though? Did the trial court disallow part of the mechanics lien for lack of itemization?
No. The trial court, the page that they failed to originally append to the mechanics lien was the part that I had conceded. It was the $40,000-some that we were seeking through the unjust enrichment claim.
Okay, maybe.
So this is the $22,000 or whatever it was.
Right. It was the balance.
So you're giving up on the $40,000. That was my original question.
$40,000? Yeah. Oh, certainly. I conceded that way back when we were in trial court. It was like, I can't argue something if it wasn't there.
All right.
So, and I'm not going to tell you that I'm arguing it here. So. And then we have the issue of unjust enrichment. Goodell and the appellants have argued that the owner of this real estate was not unjustly enriched. Simply wrong. The owner of the real estate is a trust. And there's no evidence in this record that the trust ever paid one red cent for any of the benefits to this real estate.
It's the Walmart store. Walmart store paid the contract price?
Correct. But the trust has never paid anything for the real estate that was improved by a Par Golf. And no one has ever paid for any of the amounts that we've made claim for, this $64,000. There's no evidence in the record that any of it was ever paid. There is some testimony by Mr. Reber, who is the owner of Bodell at time of trial, that he had finally received compensation from the store. He was asked how much, couldn't tell. It was established, though, that we were never received any of what was due and owing to an innocent counsel as conceded. Nothing was ever paid for any of these extras.
Isn't that kind of immaterial when you're just saying it's not material because what Walmart stores pays doesn't have anything to do with the unjust enrichment claim? In other words, you claim you unjustly enriched Walmart Trust, who's the owner of the land.
I'm saying that Walmart Trust has been benefited by all of the improvements that Par Golf made to this real estate, including all of these extras. And we have not been paid for those extras. And in any event, the trust has never paid for any of it. We never were able to understand.
The argument ends there, doesn't it? I mean, I don't know why you and I are arguing about this. There's no showing that Walmart Trust paid for anything. They're the landowner, therefore you can obtain unjust enrichment against them.
That was our argument.
And all right. Okay. Thank you.
And then, first of all, at trial, there was evidence that was submitted that Bodell was paid, but we don't know how much. But the store is not the owner. Again, the trust is. The third, the money that was owing to Par Golf under that original contract, including the change orders and the entire extras, nothing was ever paid on that again. To argue, as does Bodell, that all of the work and material provided by Par Golf to repair the damage done to the retention basin by this rainstorm and due to the defective installation of this inlet simply begs credibility. This work was requested by Bodell as an agent for the store, and Bodell agreed that Par Golf would be compensated. The property was benefited. Par Golf has suffered as a result since it's not been paid. Fourth, there were numerous authorities that were cited by the appellants. The South Dakota cases that were cited in support of their authority do not stand for the propositions for which they were offered. We have Belton versus McDonald that simply stands for the idea that without privity, a contractor cannot hold the owner of property personally liable under a contract between the contractor and the owner lessee. That's been well established well before that in such cases as Kelly Lumber, or Curly Power, Keeley Lumber, rather. And then we have Hofelt versus Mailing, which they cited. That was an unjust enrichment case and did not involve a mechanics foreclosure. The court there found that the complaining party had received what they otherwise would have received, and therefore there was no unjust enrichment. Here, Par Golf has not received what it's otherwise entitled to, and therefore should be compensated. We have the offsets that are claimed by Bedell. They made an offset claim for work they did to the retention dam after Par Golf left the job in August. All of Par Golf's repairs were to that dam, and it was done at the specific oral and written requests of the foreman, again, the project foreman. Trial court was correct in finding that this work was ordered by Bedell and that they failed to meet their burdens of production and persuasion. I see my time's about up. In conclusion, the trial court had the opportunity to try this case over a two-day period. The judge had the full opportunity to view and hear the witness for the plaintiff, who was Grant Manunkester, and the witness for the appellants for Bedell, Mr. Eric Reber, the owner of that company. The trial court believed Mr. Manunkester and did not accept what Mr. Reber had to say on the points that are of any significance. None of the trial court's findings are clearly erroneous, and the trial court did not commit any errors that would constitute reversible error. Thus, the trial court's decision must be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jones. Ms. Sumner, you have 10 minutes, sir.
First, the question you asked, sir, about the challenge to the finding about payment. On page 22 of the appellant's brief, we assert that there's no dispute about the fact that Walmart has not been unjustly enriched because they accepted and retained the work that they've already paid for under the general contract. And on the argument that where he talks about the repair work and the vandalism, in saying that that Bodell is simply asserting an argument out of the blue, in Exhibit 103 in this record, we have the technical specification for planting. It's 02900, and there is a provision in that technical specification for maintenance during construction. It's section 3.7, and that's the section in large part that we are referring to and relying upon to assert that it is that the work for which they're claiming is an extra is work that's required under the contract. So
that just relates to water and nothing else.
Well, so there are subparagraphs A through Q, and on the erosion question and this vandalism argument. So it says one of the requirements is there to protect the seated area from pedestrian or vehicular trespassing while grass is germinating. They're also to provide fences, signs, barriers, and other necessary temporary protective devices. And they're all also required to repair damage resulting from trespass, which we submit as the vandalism, erosion, which is their argument about the rainstorm, washout, settlement, or other causes. So we have a very expressed contractual foundation in the technical specifications for the...
Well, what did the trial court, though? Didn't the trial court find otherwise and make inner findings of fact that were contrary to what you're arguing here now?
Well, they ruled in favor of Par Golf. But they didn't make any rulings about this. The odd thing in this case is that Mr. Neumkester himself has admitted that his subcontract required him to perform work in requirement in accordance with the plans and specifications. Then he goes on to argue, however, that he somehow was excused from having to provide this maintenance during construction because of something he says he put in his bid. But he never put his bid into evidence. And in addition, the subcontract says, it is expressly says, is not to be modified by anything in an antecedent bid. So their whole defense to this, their whole basis for their assertion of this claim for extras, while it acknowledges that the work they did was within the scope of the specification, is reliant upon the unsubstantiated assertion by Mr. Neumkester that he was excused from complying with that part of the specification because of something he says he put in his bid. But again, the bid isn't in evidence, and the bid forms no part of the contract. The subcontract specifically states the bid shall provide no part of the contract, and Mr. Neumkester expressly acknowledged that if but for this reservation he was relying upon in his bid, he would have been required to provide the maintenance that is the subject of this dispute under the terms of the specifications. So that's the nub of that issue. But again, I'm going to reiterate, this court need not reach that issue for several reasons, dealing with the mechanics lien, the unjust enrichment, and arbitration in that sequence.
What about the argument unjust enrichment that the trust did not pay a nickel, the store did, and the trust is the owner, therefore the owner hasn't paid?
This issue is something that Par Golf is raising for the first time in appeal. This issue was never presented to the trial court. There's no finding or conclusion by the trial court on this issue. There's nothing. The trial court, in effect, treated Walmart as an entity, not distinguishing between the trust and the store. There's nothing in the record.
The pleadings contest that completely. I mean, one defendant is Walmart Real Estate Business Trust, and another defendant is Walmart Stores. So how can you say that?
Hey, Walmart, you need to understand, sir, that this case involved claims by numerous other subcontractors those claims have since been resolved and dismissed. Two of the other subcontractors sued Walmart Stores, Inc. This party did not sue Walmart Stores, Inc. None of those other cases went to trial. In this case, I would submit that the Par Golf, as the plaintiff, has the burden of proof. And yet Par Golf can cite to nothing in its record to substantiate its assertion concerning the relationship between Walmart Stores, Inc. and Walmart Real Estate Business Trust. There's nothing in this record to demonstrate that they are separate entities or that Walmart Real Estate Business Trust is not a part of Walmart Stores, Inc. And Par Golf is a party with the burden of proof on that point. The simple fact is that...
Do you dispute that Walmart Trust is the owner of the real estate, the landowner?
As a matter of record at the courthouse, Walmart Real Estate Business Trust has the title.
Well, if that's the case, then just address the legal argument if we get to it. I mean, if the trust is the owner and the trust hasn't paid, what's your legal argument on the unjust enrichment claim? Because the owner technically hasn't paid.
Well, you know, I would think that there should be a requirement on the plaintiff to demonstrate that Walmart Business Trust has somehow received something for which it has not provided consideration. And there's nothing in this record to substantiate their claim. What we have is a construction contract that identifies Walmart Stores, Inc. as the owner. That's the language of the contract.
Owner of the building or the owner of the land?
I'm going to say owner for purposes of the general contract. It doesn't it doesn't express itself on that specific question. And I will submit that Walmart Stores, Inc., in effect, was acting as the agent for Walmart Real Estate Business Trust for purposes of constructing this store and paying for it. And there's no evidence in this case to the contrary.
I assume you go down the records, you check the records in the county that Spearfish is in, and it shows Walmart Trust, or the full name, as it's stated in the pleadings, Walmart Real Estate Business Trust, is the owner of the real estate, correct? And are you disputing they're not a separate entity?
Yes.
You're claiming they're the same entity? Have you put any proof into the record of that? They have a different name and they both are listed as corporations.
Okay. First, I'll state that Part Off has the burden of proof. Second, I'll state that this issue was never raised with the trial court, that Pardoff has done nothing to preserve this issue for appeal, that they raised this issue only for the first time on appeal, that the court, trial court in effect, has treated Walmart as a single entity for purposes of payment under this project. There's no finding seeking to distinguish one from another. And Walmart has paid in full. And it's not like Walmart Real Estate Business Trust is somehow unrelated to Walmart Stores, Inc.
And I know, but they've chosen to become different entities. They've chosen to do business that way, one to own the building and one to own the land, and now they're trying to hide from it, I think.
Well...
And you can get an unjust enrichment claim against somebody who owns the land, right?
Only in the circumstance where the facts demonstrate that they have received something where under some circumstance where it's unjust that they be allowed to retain that without payment.
Right. But
there has been full payment.
And if they have a dispute with Walmart Stores because or if Walmart Stores has a dispute with them, that's between them, isn't it?
Well, if the general contractor were asserting this claim, this might be something of arguable interest. But in this case, there is no dispute between the general contractor and the owner of the property. This is the tempest in a teapot. This is a dispute with a subcontractor over watering, something for which there's no dispute. The general contractor has been paid in full, and I submit it doesn't matter a whole lot in the circumstances of this case just exactly what the relationship is between Walmart Real Estate Business Trust and Walmart Stores, Inc., because the general contractor has been paid in full, and this is not a claim for extras beyond the scope of the general contract.
Your time has expired, Mr. Sumner. Thank you. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.